Stony Island Audio.
And now, it's time for the Dad Bod Rap Pod with your hosts, Damone Carter, David Ma, and Nate LeBlanc.
Dad Bod Rap Pod, we are back another week, more rap talk with the three bad brothers you know so well. I am Damone Carter, aka Dim One. I am joined in the Zoom by my mellow, my man, Nate LeBlanc. What's happening?
Hey guys, what's going on? What is happening? It's that weird sports time where every sport is sporting. Yeah. It's football, yes. It's baseball playoffs, NBA basketball is tonight. Kicking off. Yeah. It's just like I don't watch as much sports as I used to, but it's still an exciting time. There's a lot to read about. There's a lot to follow. Andrew Wiggins got vaccinated. I'm weirdly excited about that. So here we are.
Yeah, he's a very, very interesting character. And the Andrew Wiggins of our program. Just kidding. I look at Dave as more like a Jarrett Jack. Remember Jarrett Jack?
Who could forget Jarrett Jack?
Yeah, like the emotional core of that, of those teams.
Like you guys have probably not seen Dave play as many times as I have, but Dave is an excellent point guard, a great passer, had a killer three-point shot in particular before he got his elbow hurt. So like your comparison is not far off, Damone, and a leader on the court, which is I think what we're talking about here.
Absolutely. And the first guy that would get into a fight, Mr. David Ball. How's it going, bro?
Yo, it's good to be here, guys. I think my hairline is more like Chris Gatling's. You guys remember him? He was like a power forward. All right.
Yes,
all right.
Anyway, with the
Gatling gun.
With the line. And,
yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah, man, good to be here, you guys. Couple weeks after Tree Ford and a couple episodes in from Squid Game and new microphones. And that's my life, dude. We're all caught up.
Yeah, it's been definitely an interesting time on several levels. We have a dope show lined up for you guys. On the other side of the segment, we are going to be talking to Blueprint, who you know as an amazing MC, but also as a podcaster who hosts Super Duty Tough Work, which is another Stony Island Sure Shot. And so, yeah, we're excited to bring you that conversation. But talking to Blueprint got us thinking about the Midwest. I know some would say that regionalism is dead in hip hop. But I love me some regionalism. And I think the Midwest is probably one of those regions, probably the most under discussed region. When you say New York, there's a particular sound or sounds in mind. When you say the West Coast, there's a particular set of sounds. Down South for sure. But it got talking to Blueprint got me thinking about like, what is the Midwest sound? There's definitely something there. He speaks on it a little bit in the interview. Don't want to tip too much, but I wanted to throw this out to you guys, and we'll start with you, Dave. When you think about the Midwest rap sound, what are some of the characteristics that come to mind for you?
I think, the Midwest, like you said, it doesn't have like huge benchmarks in terms of just the aesthetics, but I think the Midwest is like a distillation of sort of the best of each coast and also a little bit of the South nowadays. For me personally, when I think of fucking Midwest hip hop, Nate and my friend Alan Johnson, aka Albert Jenkins, we went to Chicago. I think it was spring of 07 or 08, and this was on you know, like fresh on the heels of the Cool Kids Bake Sale being out, and I just remember that song, I mean that album, particularly the album itself, because it was like a trunk rattling type album that was just blasting everywhere. So I really like going into locales and being like, okay, this is the pride at the moment. So that that experience stands out to me in terms of Midwest rap. But of course, I mean, I'm a 40-year-old dude, and so, you know, sort of my emergence was during the indie rap boom. So sure. Atmosphere, you know, Slug and Ant, they're near and dear to my heart. I mean, I certainly sort of checked out for like a decade or so, but that doesn't mean that what they made and the scene that they cultivated isn't awesome. And they stand out to me when I think about Midwest hip hop and like what you were saying, regionalism. What about you guys?
I think it's especially in the more underground thing of what we're talking about is like a ruggedness with the beats, but then like an introspection in the lyrics, like where those two things come together is what I think of. Like we've talked on many episodes about like kind of like Detroit drums and how like dirty they are. And there's something very evocative about that. And then I do think Blueprint, Illogic, Slug, a lot of kind of like independent backpacky, if you will, kind of scribble jam sort of MCs have this, like they were early to what is common now, which is doing kind of like an introspective, like not afraid to talk about your feelings. Like they're great MCs and they rap about rapping, but they were able to access real human emotions and bring them to the fore early. And then you just kind of have like your fun, like MC Breed, like curiosities and like early hits where you're like, oh, this is like a different, like, you know, it kind of gets lumped in with G-Funk, but it's like, oh, this is a Flint, Michigan rap. There's Flint, Michigan rap. Like, it's just an interesting kind of thing. And Dave pointed it out already, but there's always been kind of a conversation between the Midwest and the Bay Area where there was an affinity for each other's music, which I've always found really interesting. Particularly Detroit and Oakland have a lot in common. So I think there's a couple of things that define it, but we're kind of approaching it from this backpack angle. I don't think this applies to like Sada Baby or Lil Durk or like some of the other stuff that kind of defines Midwest rap in the more mainstream hip hop ecosystem of the moment. That's just kind of like a really skillful attacking kind of style of rapping, which is amazing in its own right, but not what I'm getting at today, if that makes sense.
No, I totally hear you. Maybe I'll approach this from a slightly different perspective, because when you talk about artists like those, it makes me go back to Twista in terms of a Midwest sound that can oftentimes mirror a West Coast attacking rhyme style with a double time and things like that. Twista being probably an under-heralded innovator in that regard. And also Common. I think Common's earnestness, when you talk about even the underground cats who came like a generation after him, I think he opened the door for this kind of like earnest kind of everyman rap that Slug and Ant kind of brought to the world through the underground channels and became such an empire in their own way. So I haven't spent a lot of time in the Midwest, but I also try to like connect the general tone and vibe of places to the rap music that is created. I spent the weekend in LA, and like I go, when you're in LA and you're listening to Tyler the Creator, you're like, yeah, this makes sense. Like this totally makes sense. And I think when I listen to Midwest hip hop, I definitely get the sense that real earnest dudes who are influenced by both coasts, but not as chauvinistic as either coast. And definitely like more inclusive of different sounds and approaches, because I don't know, maybe when you don't touch an ocean, you don't have a complex. I don't know what it is.
Well, I think it's
go ahead.
Step on your toes. I just feel like it's a little bit more expansive than like what we're giving it credit for. And we're really speaking through this like backpack sort of gaze, but I mean, like, you know, Chance the Rapper, you know what I mean? Like, I don't think of, when I hear him, I'm not like, oh, this is so Midwest. You know what I mean?
Okay. Or Kanye. Like, I mean, let's look at the giants of this industry. Yeah,
exactly. Bone Thugs. Right. I mean, you know, we're speaking of it through a very sort of specific gaze, and that's sort of like the backpack Maker and Quell and Typical Cats and that stuff. And I listen to that as well, but you know, let us not forget the Bone Thugs as well, you know, and it's more expansive than we thought.
This is something that's come up a couple of times recently, and maybe we need to do a deep dive so I can re-listen, but someone, I can't forget who, and they might have said this to me in real life, not online, was like, Bone Thugs just doesn't get talked about for as much as they sold. Like, their impact seems to have, like, kind of dissipated, and I don't know if it's because, like, none of the guys really had huge second acts, or if, like, they're, like, style, like, this is a kind of a weird point to make, but they kind of remind me of Boys to Men in that way.
Wow.
Boys to Men were like inescapable. Yeah, and I was such a huge fan of theirs. And now they're like on the county fair circuit. Like, so weird how you can go from being so huge to, and I don't want to say not relevant because there are references to things and we all have nostalgia for them, but like, it's a curious kind of a place they hold in the current conversation. For some people, that's like their favorite music from when they grew up. Sure. But what can you point to that really was born of that? I don't know. It's
I kind of feel like what they did was they popularized a style and then folks kind of took it and ran with it. And they took it from Freestyle Fellowship. We can get into that on another 100. Episode. But when I listened to Notorious Thugs with Biggie and Bone Thugs, when he takes their flow and basically does a halftime double time, and then everybody in the East Coast after that was like, oh, that's how you do it. It was, so they to me are kind of like a link to people who didn't know how to rap like that. They were like, oh, this is how you rap like that. So they popularized the style. They came along at a particular time. I think by the time they were fucking with Phil Collins, it just got to be kind of almost gimmicky, which is sad, because I do think in some ways they were definitely talented, but their approach, I think, was so big, so quick, so hot that it kind of petered out. But at the same time, when I listened to a 3-6 Mafia, or you listen to there's Chicago rap and things, and I hear bits and pieces of the double time flow, and I think Bone Thugs has to be given credit for popularizing that style and bringing it. And they sold a freaking kajillion records at a time.
Totally. I'm sorry, I keep fucking stepping on your toes, dude. It's this new mic. It's coming in hot.
Too much power.
I think there a lot of weird things happened to them in after the 2000s as well. You know, Busy Bone going on radio shows and coming off like a crackhead and. Yeah. Just weird beefs that they had. I think they're just hugely viewed as uncool now. So people don't want to give props to some shit that they listened to in middle school. You know, even if it, like Nate was saying, there are huge connects to what they did and what they eventually popularized.
So you're saying that they've reached the end of the road.
They're at a crossroads and
but it is the first of the month almost, so I don't know, I had to get that joke.
Missed their Uncle Charles, we get it. No.
Dang it. So we were definitely fortunate to talk to Blueprint, who goes deep into the history of both Ohio rap, and then also talks a little bit about Cincinnati and some different areas that we don't typically think about, and some of the forerunners in those areas. And it was interesting. You'll hear him just talking just a bit, but it was interesting to hear him talk about the influence of battling. I think both of you guys brought up kind of Scribble Jam as an influence. Nate, can you talk just a little bit about like how that scene and like that approach became part of the Midwest vibe, or at least to our understanding?
Yeah, I mean, I'm no expert on this subject matter, but in my world, like a Scribble Jam title, like Mac Lethal won the Scribble Jam battle, that automatically makes him an MC who must be checked for. It was very prestigious. And we came from a world of DJ battles, but there was MC battling was not really a huge thing on the West Coast, or like in here in the Bay Area that I was a part of, or that I really cared about. The freestyle chops and the kind of things that mattered were done in concert, not in structured battles that I was a part of. But I would go to DJ battles all the time. Our friends from the Bangers and other kind of associates of ours were in battles at the time, especially team battles. So I was very familiar with that DJ battle world, but to see it kind of taken to this other MC level. And we've asked a bunch of our past guests about Scribble Jam times, and I'm interested in the stories of that time. And it seems to have functioned kind of like a meeting of the minds for people who were of a certain ilk. It was kind of like this low budget, like gathering, not to use the Juggalo terminology, which immediately is an offshoot of Midwest rap.
Midwest.
We're not talking about where people kind of tested their mettle against each other. And Sage Francis' career had a huge boost off of winning one of the early battles there.
Right.
There are legendary battles people still talk about from that time. And I'm going to contrast that a little bit with a point that I was about to make, which was Blueprint in particular, such a nice guy. And he has what I would call like a Midwestern niceness. He's a polite gentleman who like was so cool to us. And as have been most of the cats we've talked to from that scene. And so it's interesting to see these nice guys like completely verbally destroy each other.
Right. And then isn't Eminem was a kind of a product of the
Eminem
of the school gem
famous scene. He famously battled Dose One, I believe, and so that was crazy. That I mean,
dogs came from like miles around.
I'm about to say, what pitch was that at?
The voices.
People would make pilgrimages to to Scribble Jam, and it was pretty cool because you could literally listen to a song and be like, oh, there's LP hanging out CDs. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Scratch Bastard's famous Star Wars juggle, I think, happened there as well. So there, I mean, there are like romanticized sort of huge moments that occurred there, which, you know, once it kind of fizzled out, it was kind of sad. And I think that kind of marked the ultimate end of the backpack era too.
That's a very interesting point. I think I want to circle back a little bit before we cut to the interview. Do we consider Kansas City Midwest? What do you consider that?
I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm no expert in these matters, but to me, it's all part of the same circuit. You can drive there within a day from there, right?
Right.
That's how I understand it to work. Like,
okay. So I would say then the heir to Bone Thugs was Tech N9ne. And Tech N9ne built a real empire. He's not somebody we talk about a whole lot. But in terms of independent hip hop in the Midwest, he was definitely, I mean, I think still is a force.
His ass off. It's totally. There is something slightly juggalish about it, though.
Sure. Well, he would play at those gatherings.
Yeah. Still does. He is popular within that scene. But like kind of I think of him in the same vein as like an E-40, who self-made dude from a really tiny scene.
Yep.
Who
hustler.
Just hustled his own. His own music in his own lane. So I think maybe in summary, the Midwest is an amalgamation of a lot of different places and scenes that is in conversation with the more chauvinistic coasts and edges of America, but generally nicer. I think in terms of people's, I don't think they have the same ego trip that rappers from the coast do. And I feel like they have something, especially when you think about places like Chicago and Detroit, they have a rich musical legacy that, you know, is still growing and changing. We talk a lot about cities here. Brooklyn is not going to be Brooklyn in 20 years. I think Detroit will still be Detroit. I think Chicago will still be Chicago. And so not sure about Minneapolis, but we are fortunate to have had Blueprint on the program to school us. I learned quite a bit in this interview with Blueprint. So let's jump to it. Here's our conversation with Blueprint Dad Bod Rap Pod. Dad Bod Rap Pod. Every week we talk to people who are moving and shaping hip hop culture. This week is no different. Joining us in Zoom, we have MC podcaster extraordinaire Blueprint. What's happening, man?
Hey, man, just doing it. How y'all doing today?
Living it. We're enjoying as we record this on Labor Day, or two thirds of us are enjoying our day off. thanks for being on the program, man. You have a very interesting career trajectory and arc. Right now you have a podcast on the Stony Island Network called Super Duty Tough Work. And I wanted to kind of start there. As somebody who's had actual success in rap, why did you start a podcast?
That's a great question, man. Okay. I like where this is going, fellas. All right. Well, you know, sometimes you don't get the most interesting questions, you know, and so I know a good question when I hear one. let me see. The reason I started is funny. It's like the same reason I started blogging in 2008. Prior to 2007, 2008, you know, blogging was kind of like, that's just for other people. And around 2007, 2008, I started really reevaluating what we now call like the direct to fan model. And I was like, how do I communicate with these people who follow me? How do I tell my story more effectively? And I was like, well, nobody in my peers aren't really blogging like that. Very few of them were, you know, those who were seeing a lot of traction on just blogging. And so I was like, I'm going to start blogging. And it was during a period where I wasn't touring. So I just started writing a lot, 2-3 blogs a week, started getting a lot of traction. And then I started seeing that, okay, the more I blog, the more people read the blogs, go to my website, purchase merchandise. And I was like, well, shit, this is the formula. So I was like, well, maybe blogging is the future. So then I realized, like, I just started blogging for a while and got good at it, which kind of led me to other things. But the same thing that I saw in blogging in 2008, I saw in podcasting, where I'm like, this is, blogging had started to kind of fade. You know, as podcasting started to come up, you got YouTube, all these different means, social media, right? Because social media wasn't as heavy in 2007, 2008 as it is now. And so I said, you know what? Podcasting is where this thing is going. Me being a fan of podcasts, I listen to a bunch of them, you know? And on tour, all we would listen to was podcasts. I'm like, and people would say, Print, man, you should get a podcast. And I would always say, I don't have shit to talk about. I'm not interesting. I don't. But then we would have these crazy ass discussions on tour. And I was like, yo, maybe I'll do it. But then I started looking. I was like, yo, I think this is going to be the next thing, just like podcasting was, you know. And when people want to really understand the people that they support, or just learning about new people, podcasting is going to be that. And I also think it was even more because I felt almost like podcasts have kind of taken a place of the blog era for those of us who are around during the blog era, where you had these hip hop infinities and these hip hop sites and ATAC and all these little sites that were popped underground hip hop. And then you had all these other, the Two Dope Boys and all these places where people would go to either read reviews about music, going to people that they trusted their opinion. Everything became more decentralized. Blogs faded as well. And as those blogs faded, I was like, yo, podcasting has, I think this is going to be it. And so that's kind of where I decided to do it. You know, 2015, I tried it. Me and Rare Groove were the original hosts. And, you know, we did our first episodes on tour. And then we got off tour. I lived in Columbus. He lived in Cincinnati. So we couldn't record that much. So I stopped. I was like, all right, fuck it. You know, he couldn't make it. So we just quit. We did about 5 episodes. And then right around the beginning of the new year, I started, bringing friends over to the house. I was like, yo, I really like this. Maybe I'll do an interview podcast. So I started bringing friends over, interviewing them, seeing who would be good. And then Logic texted me one day like, yo, you should let me join Super Duty Tough Work, man. I love what y'all's doing. Bring it back. And I was like, all right. And that's kind of started 2.0 with a Logic. And that's kind of what got us here. But it was just seeing in podcasting what I saw in blogging in 2007, 2008.
And for those who maybe don't know about the podcast, can you talk a little bit about what Super Duty Tough Work is and kind of the format and themes that you guys deal with?
Yeah, Super Duty Tough Work is a podcast where we kind of combine certain things. Like, we're obviously hip hop guys, so everything kind of comes from that perspective. But we also try to do like self-improvement, doing better work, personal development. We try to be encouraging and kind of share the things that we wish older artists would have told us when we were coming up. We try to play that role. So I think to a lot of younger artists who listen to us, you know, when I talk to them offline and everything, like, that's what hits them the hardest, is that we're actually sharing things with them that no one around them will share, helping them become better and more serious about their craft. And we're doing it in a hip hop way, you know, and we try to make it, you know, edutainment and you know, to quote Karis One with like that, because we know that just sitting there and telling people what to do ain't really that entertaining. You know what I mean? It's actually boring. You know what I mean? Like we don't want to be like the teachers that people don't want to listen to anyway. And so we present it in our unique way, and there's some tongue in cheek, and we bug out sometimes, but it's all to keep people's attention and talk about topics that can help people ultimately.
That's great, man. Thank you so much for the explanation. We're talking about the current day, your current situation, the podcasting, but I think, especially for us here, we first heard of you back in the day. For me personally, it was on RJD2's Final Frontier. Mm-hmm. And I just want to, kind of use that as a springboard and go backwards, because you were fully part of the hub, Sage Francis, Idea, Vast Air, Mars mm-hmm. Ill, Slug, just fully a part of the indie rap backpack movement. Can you just give our younger audiences a sense of what it was like being there?
It's funny. I just thought about that the other day, man. And somebody had told me something. I was thinking about this feeling that was in the air back then. It was a new, exciting thing, because honestly, we didn't even have there was no real genre for us. There was no lane. It was like the guys who were not quite boom bap enough to get played on Stretch and Bobbito. The guys from the Midwest, we weren't from the West Coast. So we weren't like coolest Project Blow to them, but we could rhyme and we took the craft very seriously. And those guys respected us, but we didn't exactly fit with them. And so what started to happen is what I noticed is that every city started to have artists who were kind of in this lane and were prominent in their scene. So when I was I grew up in Columbus, I moved to Cincinnati. And as I got to Cincinnati, the biggest groups down there were Mood, Lone Catalysts, J. Rawls, High Tech. In Columbus, it was me, a Logic, Megahertz, RJD2, right? All these different scenes. You go over to Minneapolis, obviously you had Slug, Idea, the Micronauts, Atmosphere, Musab, who's known as Beyond back then. Chicago, they had Birthright Records and a bunch of guys there who were doing great works, Macrobats and all those wild ass Chicago groups, nasty MCs. And then, we started noticing too, the internet started bringing us together. So I met the Adams Family on, I don't even know if y'all remember this, but it was this place out west called ATAK, ATAK. They used to sell tapes, right?
That's from our hometown, San Jose.
Okay, yeah. I used to buy tapes off of ATAK back in the day. I bought my first bus driver tape off of there. And they used to have a message board. And so I remember somehow me and Cryptic One started talking about stuff. He was promoting his Persecution of Hip Hop thing that he had just dropped. And we had our Greenhouse and the Logic tapes. And we were on there just chopping it up. And somehow he and I took the conversation off. And I started building about just hip hop and shit. And ultimately, we became super tight. So we started, our whole crew started going out to New York. It would be me, a Logic, Greenhouse. We would go out to New York and spend a weekend or two at Cryptic's house in Long Island. We'd all sleep on the floor. And then Crypt and were cool with Aesop. So this was before Def Jux existed. And so this was around the time when LP had just met Canox. So we started hearing all the Canox demos, like the first song recorded, like Metal Gear and that shit. We had all of that shit. So for me, it was like, all of these crews, though, because we knew each other and we would see each other on the circuit, and the circuit really was developed, in my opinion, by Atmosphere and Rubber Room. Those were the first two groups I ever saw touring in our lane. Jay Bird, who ultimately started working for Atmosphere, he's their manager now, works for Rhymesayers, he managed Rubber Room first. But he used to book Atmosphere and seeing what they were doing. So he booked the national tour with Rubber Room and Atmosphere. And that was one of the first times I saw guys in our lane going out. And then Atmosphere came back and did tours with Micronauts. And then, but the circuit was starting to get developed. And as the circuit got developed, we all started getting cool. So within 1 month, I was living in Cincinnati. The rest of my crew lived in Columbus, 100 miles away. Mr. Dibbs books Atmosphere at one of his shows in Cincinnati. Hey, Prince, y'all want to play? Yep, we want to play. We fuck with them. Cool. We play with them. We all get cool. Idea and a Logic are 1 year apart. They're both 18, 19. they instantly hit it off. Me and Slug get tight. Next thing you know, 2 months later, like, hey, man, we got this show in Columbus at this spot called FM. Y'all want to play with us there? Yeah, we'll play there. Cool. We go open up from Columbus. This is my hometown. Boom. Month later, hey, man, we got booked in Cleveland at this spot called the Euclid Tavern. Y'all want to come up there? It's a Thursday night. Shit, we'll drive. Fuck it. We drive up to Cleveland. 2 months later was Scribble Jam. So all of these things started lining up where we're all on the same circuit. We're playing all at the same place. We ended up playing. Me, all the waitlist, all the Adams fam got booked in Chicago playing with Idea once. Slug was there working merch. So it was a circuit. We started exchanging music. That's kind of what formed the relationships. You know, the tapes back then, we would get a tape and the tape would have, Crypto would give me a tape. It would have Canuck songs on it. Some Aesop shit he might produce. Some Hangar 18 shit before people knew what Hangar 18 was. You know, all these miscellaneous Adams Family groups. We give them a tape. It has some Greenhouse, some Drown, some Pleat the Fifth, some CJ Cynics, some Blueprint shit, some Soul Position shit. Idea give Illogic a tape. This is how things were going. And this is ultimately how, like, Def Jux kind of got signed. You know, for Columbus, the movement, the biggest thing was Megahertz getting signed to Fondalum. When Megahertz got signed to Fondalum and that world premiere single came out, man, that was just wildfire. Like, the whole scene was just, that was the first song in Columbus hip hop where everybody in the venue knew every word. Camus wouldn't even rap. He would just, "Hand on the doors, okay, but you're riding." And he'd just hold the mic and everybody would be yelling this complex ass rhyme with him, you know? And it was just amazing. And I was just a fan, like, yo, this is crazy. I want to be that, you know, I want to be where they're at, what they're doing, you know? And I still had a job then. I wasn't even thinking. We would just record every week. But the relationships and the circuit was being built around us. It was all new. We didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't think it was real until that Chicago show. And I saw Slug signing autographs and he wasn't even performing. And I was like, what the fuck is this, man?
Wow. I really do appreciate you illustrating that for us. As West Coasters, we saw a similar thing happen in our area, but it's cool to hear about the kind of Midwest and New York take on that. I'm wondering how that affected you as an MC. Like, did you feel that you needed to keep up with the Joneses? Like, did you feel like you needed to get better to, like, hang with these guys? Or did you feel like you came into it, like, just a bad MC and they had to keep up with you? Like, can you talk a little bit about that friendly competition aspect?
Well, the thing about me and Columbus, the whole Columbus scene, what a lot of people don't know is it's ultra, ultra competitive. You, in those days of Columbus, if you couldn't freestyle in battle, you couldn't get on the mic. You had to be able, like, I was able to get on the mic because I was the guy who battled in my crew. Every crew had a motherfucker who had to be able to freestyle and battle. Megahertz had copyright. You know, Blueprint was Weightless's guy. Everybody had those guys. You know, you had certain crews who had multiple, you know, a Stronghold. They had Poison Pen and C-Rays. You know what I mean? You had to see them fools if you was good. And Breeze. Really, all them dudes could go. But, like, so Columbus was so competitive that I never even thought about the greater competitive nature of the shit. Because it was like, you can't even get on the mic in your city if you're not nice. And if you're not willing to battle any motherfucker in here. So there was nights I would take motherfuckers outside and serve them if they was talking shit at the mic. I would battle motherfuckers right then and there. The Scribble Jam battle to me was the first organized battle I ever got in. That was like 82 MCs. I'd never been on a stage battling with time limits and shit like that. I was a street battler, a cypher battler. That was my shit. That's why me and Idea were super tight. We would go places where before motherfuckers knew who we were. We would be in these scenes where we might not even be playing and we'd just be serving motherfuckers. Whoever they said was the tightest, me and Idea would just be trying to battle them because we were just into the challenge of it, just friendly shit. So, like, I never thought about it like I got to get tighter because of the scene is doing this. I knew automatically, and me and everybody in our scene knew, like, you're never going to be shit in your city if you can't hold it down because Columbus, you know, it's founded on the back of a couple open mic nights that were, like, legendary here. One was called the Groove Shack. Groove Shack was this record store in like 1995, and they had open mics, and it would just, and they would have a DJ there, and it would just be nothing there but rappers battling. This shit got put on public access TV. I don't know who got it on there, but it just blew up in Columbus after that. And so you, and to go there to rhyme, you had to be ready to go. The first time I went, I was too intimidated. I was like, I'm not getting nowhere near this. I walked outside. I saw a copyright on the corner. He was like 15. Camus was like 15. And they were serving like 30-year-old dudes, 25-year-old dudes, crushing everybody. And I was like, well, holy shit, these two motherfuckers are badasses. I need to go work on my shit. But it was like, that was just to get on a mic in Columbus. And then it went from that thing shut down. Then it moved to some spot called Smiling Rhino, another super competitive open mic. Same shit. Like, dudes would take the mic out your hand if you're not murdering it. You got to be ready to fight if you wanted to rhyme back in the days. If you was whack, you some motherfuckers just would ease up on you and just slowly slide the mic out your hand. Like, you done, partner. That's how I came up. You know what I mean? So it's like, and if somebody sucked, we would just pass the mic around this motherfucker. Like, he'd be sitting there all night from 11 o'clock till the lights come on. When they be like, last call, then we stop passing the mic around this fool. Like, nah, you ain't getting none of it. Nah, but nah. No, you got to prove it. So it went from that. Then it went to Spot Bernie's, which was Prism's night. Prism had this open Prism from Spitball Crew. Same thing, bro. Then and at the same time this is going on, Cincinnati has an open mic, has a weekly hip hop night, just like the one in Columbus, Top Cats. And they have battles every week. 8-man, 16-man tournaments. Their shit was more battling than hearing hip hop songs. Columbus was at least like a cipher at the end of you hearing jams. Cincinnati was just like, hey, 9 o'clock, sign up for the cipher. The DJ's gonna scratch for about an hour. We're battling the rest of the night. That's what it was like here. It was super competitive. So like, that's the thing that people don't know about Columbus and Cincinnati. To just get out at that time, you had to be the nicest. So nationally, once we got out of here, we was like, oh, cool. Everything easy now.
That's dope. So you cut your teeth in a cutthroat scene. I want to talk a little bit, or I would like you to talk a little bit about your relationship, both your working and personal relationship with RJD2. Like Dave, my introduction to your music was the Final Frontier joint, which I was like, who is this guy? Because you come from that battle tradition, and I'll be honest with you, that don't always translate well to a record.
It's true.
You know what I mean? Like a lot of the scribble jam type stuff, a lot of dudes were super nice, but it never quite translated to the record. But I heard your stuff and I was like, oh, he's a spitter who actually knows how to like work in song form. So could you just talk a little bit about working with RJD2 and like what it was like to get to know him?
Yeah, I mean, me and RJ met because of a mutual friend who was a DJ. Like there's a guy in Columbus named DJ True Skills. He's kind of like the OG of like digging in the scene here because he's the first guy who had like a record shop. He had like a corner in a record shop and it was called Thieves World. And he would basically sell all the underground records, like all the vinyl, that first vinyl movement of like all the Fondalum shit and ABB record, all that shit. He would have all that shit. And so he would sell all of that. And then he was the first guy to sell Columbus artist music. And so he was our kind of, he was our DJ. And we started doing shows at Greenhouse. He knew everybody. Still does. And so one day, as he's, me and him are talking, I'm playing him a bunch of weird instrumental shit. And this isn't like the year 2000 or 99. He's like, yo, this shit is bugged the fuck out. Like, you know, I just know you as rap. I know you may know weirdo shit like this. He's like, man, you got to meet RJ. And I'm like, who's RJ? He's like, oh, he's in the megahertz. He's been living out in the Bay for the last few years. He just moved back. You got some weird instrumental shit. He got some weird instrumental shit. Next time you home, I'm going to take you over there. That's all right, cool. He takes me over to RJ's house. Me and RJ sit there. RJ plays to me what is going to be Dead Ringer. I play for him what was my chamber music album. He and I get cool immediately on some producer shit. I told him I rhyme, but he never heard me rhyme at that point. You know what I'm saying? So he didn't know. Month or two later, he comes out to the show where Greenhouse is playing. He sees me play. He sees me rhyme with my crew. It was all of us, big ass like posse show. And after it's over, he's like, dude, he's like, have you ever thought about doing some solo shit? I was like, nah, I don't even have no solo songs. I've never even thought about it. I'm cool being a producer and rhyming with my crew. And he's like, I got this. I'm working on a single deal. He said, I got a single deal with a label from UK. And the A side I want to put this instrumental song on it. And in the B side, I want to do a song with a vocalist. He's like, let's do something for that. I was like, cool, let's do it. Sends me the beats. The first beat I pick out is The Final Frontier. That's the very first song we ever recorded together, me and him. The deal falls through. By, you know, he sits around for a year or two, kind of in limbo, gets the music back. By this time, Def Jux and Rhymesayers are starting to bubble, you know, and then LP hears about him. He starts getting heard. He's like, oh, shit. Print, can I put that song on Dead Ringer? I'm like, sure, you know, because I gave it to you for your record anyway. And, you know, we after that song, we started recording even more, just kind of we formed a crew. And, you know, the name was he had a DJ night with True Skills called Soul Position Night. It would play 45s. And I remember we were like, we need a name for the crew. And I just saw the flyer sitting on the table, Soul Position. I was like, we're going to call it Soul Position. And he was like, all right, cool. And that was just the name of the crew. And he and I just kind of I credit him for being a guy who kind of inspired me to even become a solo artist, because I had no desire. I did not see myself as that or even being that good. I just was happy doing what I was doing. But he kind of heard something in me and then, you know, inspired me to write. And those songs, all those songs, that first set of Soul Position songs from the Unlimited EP and 8 Million Stories and all of that stuff. And those are the first solo songs I ever really wrote. I never really had. I was, you know, a lot of guys, they'll come in those situations. They'll have been making demos and doing songs and albums, and then they'll get that. That wasn't me. I was making music. I was making albums with Illogic. I was making albums with Greenhouse. So I knew how to make an album. I just hadn't been a writer or a solo artist. So like his and our relationship came from that, you know, and we always have been just friends, music or no music. You know, we still talk and chop it up. So that's always my guy. And he's back here in Columbus now, you know, and I don't know if we're going to release a new record soon. We got a new record. It's just timing. You know what I'm saying? And so like we recorded a record several years ago, but the timing just kind of got fucked up with like, okay, when are you touring? What can you put into it? What can you? And so it's, and then all this COVID stuff just fucked up everybody's plans. So really, I think everybody's kind of trying to, you know, figure out what's going on. But yeah, that's how RJ and I met, you know. And then, you know, the Soul Position thing came, as I was saying, like we had all these connections where we're passing around tapes. Slug, Idea, Sadiq start hearing Soul Position. They hear Share This With You. Idea's like, yo, you got to hear this fucking song. All these dudes are playing this to Share This. Adam's like, yo, what the fuck is this? And it was just shit we were working on. And then that's how Soul Position ended up being, because we were like, we could have went to either Def Jux or Rhymesayers. I was like, RJ, you already on Def Jux. Let's take the Soul Position shit over here to Rhymesayers, because I'm touring with these guys and I'm cool with them. So we'll put two bags in different baskets and see how this shit play out. And that's how we kind of end up with Rhymesayers. But we had relationships with both. And they were interested in all of it. And in some weird way, it was almost like Columbus was almost like a feeder system to that whole movement, you know, if you will.
Mm. Thank you for that, man. What a great explanation. You know, you mentioned so much fruitful creative partnerships, and I need to bring up Illogic. Obviously you guys are still working together with the podcast, but one of the first songs that like struck me in the face when I first heard of y'all were, My Favorite Things, Illogic featuring you. And did you produce that as well?
Yeah. Yep. I produced that whole
album. Can you let us know like what went into that song? I mean, you mentioned Hip Hop Infinity earlier. I remember that just blazing Hip Hop Infinity's message boards on a fire. And it's one of my personal favorite songs of yours. Can you just break it down of how you put that together and the construction behind that?
Yeah. Well, that song, I mean, it was kind of, that whole record, he and I would just, because he was going to UC at the time. He was a freshman in college. He was smoking weed with Dose One every day, flunking out of his classes. And then, you know, then he would come over to my house, you know, and be like, let's record an album. I'm like, all right, cool, you know, because I was working as a computer programmer. So I was like, we were just doing music all the time. And so I'd pick him up probably every Friday night. And we would, if he wasn't doing music with Dose Nim, with what would soon become Anacon, you know, he was doing music with me. And that song was like, you know, back then it was like, I want to sample something and just kind of do it in our own way. And that was us. We wanted to do it, but doing it our own way. And like the Favorite Things was like, it just felt good. Like sometimes it's like a happy song. Like, you know, let's just talk about hip hop. These are our favorite things. And then we wrote it right then and on the spot together and did it. And we didn't think nothing of it until we started performing it. And in Columbus, that was one of our first big songs in Columbus. So like out of all the stuff we did, first Greenhouse, his thing, that song was the first song that really stuck, where we would do shows and people like, favorite things, do favorite things. And we'd do it and the whole crowd would be yelling and we would just be tripping like, this is crazy. It was crazy.
It became one of their favorite things.
Yeah. I see what you did there. Yeah.
So on Super Duty Tough Work, you guys dispense so much advice. You act as the OG figure and kind of put people up on game, and we really appreciate it. I'd like to tell you that podcaster to podcaster, love what you guys do. My question is, who do you call for advice?
Oh man, shit. I have certain people, man. If I was thinking of the people I call when I need somebody to tell me what's up, it would probably be Sadiq from Rhymesayers. Me and Sadiq have been friends for a long time because when we have a lot in common. So like when Rhymesayers was first starting to, before I think I was even an artist on Rhymesayers, we were kind of similar. I was like running waitlists, had artists, you know, had a Logic, Greenhouse, Zero Star, Envelope. And so, and then they had Rhymesayers, they're working on their thing. And so he and I would be on the phone chopping it up just about the business of running a label. They trading resources on whether it's publicists, distributors, how do certain things work? How do end caps work? How does this ad rate work? How do you, you know, all of these things. And so he and I kind of have a relationship like that prior to our artist label manager relationship. And so then as I obviously got on a label, our relationship kind of translated into that, but he's still somebody that I call for advice, strategy, you know, like there's my guy named Swamberg. I don't know if you know the fuck with Soliloquist of Sound. Swam is like, he's just like, he puts the battery in my back. You know what I mean? Like he's just like one of those friends just like, yeah, just do that shit. You know, he's like, he made me feel like a superhero. When I need to feel like a superhero, Swam is just like that guy. Cause he's just so gregarious and just positive, you know? And so he and I just bug out all the time, but I trust him, you know, with giving me good advice. I mean, the Logic is obviously we talk on cam, but off to cam, you know, we talk even more about like strategy and what she be doing and what works and what doesn't work. And, you know, but those are probably the biggest. I mean, Slug is good. Slug is really good. You know, I'd give him props too, because he definitely has helped me kind of, I'll say become a better artist and give me something to strive towards, you know. He set an example for Rhymesayers that I think a lot of people don't understand who is not in there, you know, like granted, if you look at like the original, I'll say the first wave of Rhymesayers artists, there's a certain way they carry themselves, you know, it was a great deal of pride in everything from how we engage fans to how we engage online, how we release our music, just a certain amount of pride there. And you see it too, and like all of us studied him and how we deal with promoters, how we deal with venues, how we, you go to a Rhymesayers show, you gonna, if you see any of us, you're going to see us standing at the table, shaking hands, signing things. That relationship with artists is some shit that he instilled in all of us. And without him, I would have never saw that even part of the game. Like I said, when I saw him signing autographs and he was just working around, I was like, what the fuck is this? What is this? I thought this was just an underground rap show. He's a fucking star. Like, is that what's on the other side? Is that what's coming? You know, like, that's what, then I went on tour with him in 2002. I was like, yeah, this is it, buddy. This is a real thing. But he taught us all a certain etiquette, a certain way of presenting yourself. He taught me how to rock a show. Like I never knew how to put together a show until I toured with him. When I toured with him and Mr. Dibs, they flew me out to Minneapolis. I was doing his backups and I was out there for a month. We would just learn words and practice. And he taught me about transitions between songs, interludes, how to make routines with you and your people, all of these things, how to really put together a dope show. I learned that from Slug, learned that from him. So it was like college for what I do now. When I went out with them in 2002, it was like that basically taught me so many things that I still apply to this day.
That's dope. We had a chance to talk to Slug right before the pandemic on an interview, and I felt like he was like on some Tony Robbins shit. Like I feel like he taught. I have to feel like I learned something from that podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a dope dude. Yeah. All right, as we kind of round home here, I'm going to ask you a question. This can be controversial. We've asked this to other folks. Can you give us your Ohio rap Mount Rushmore? The four artists who, if you had to pick, what four Ohio artists would you put on the rap route Mount Rushmore?
I'm dying to see if you pick yourself. I'm going to.
And I was like, I can't pick myself.
Huh? I mean, you can't. There's no parameters here. Just to let you know, didn't Sky Zoo pick himself?
Did he?
I think he wanted to pick himself.
But... Yeah, yeah. So don't feel bad if you want to go that route.
Was Sky Zoo's just Brooklyn or was it just?
Yeah, it was. It was just Brooklyn.
Okay. Yeah. Shit. Ohio. Man, let me think. I mean, as a producer, you have to put High Tech on there. As a DJ, you probably got to put Mr. Dibs on there. That's two Cincinnati guys. Cleveland, it would be hard to... I'm torn to Cleveland because I would say either... Might have to put Cudi on there. Maybe. Although he was kind of gone. You know what I mean? He wasn't a guy who came up through the local scene. He just kind of popped. He didn't have no fucking crazy mixtapes or nothing like that. Columbus. Yeah, this is tough, man. I'm just, cause, you know, because if I'm not on this motherfucker, then I'm putting RJ and let me think. Who else? It's probably a tie between Camu and Copy.
Okay. Ooh. Okay. That's formidable. That's formidable. And you know what I like? You're the first person to actually make that a hip hop list. Right. It wasn't exclusively for rappers, which we appreciate the expansiveness. Super Duty Tough Work. You guys are chugging along. We are bros on the Stony Island Podcast Network, which has been super cool. Glad to be down with the winning team.
Come on over to Death Row. Come on over to Death Row. Tired of these other podcast networks. All up in your videos. Dancing. Dude. You know what I mean? I'm glad y'all came on over to Death Row. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Man. It's been good with Suge Open Eagle. As we're kind of wrapping here, what's up next for Super Duty Tough Work and what's up next for you?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's like back to music. You know, the last year I released two books, you know, and you know, it was the pandemic, wasn't really that much else to do. And so now it's like, okay, I'm finally getting back to music. So like I have like several instrumental projects. I got this single I'm putting out at the end of this month. I've got a instrumental album, Chamber Music Part 2. My next solo record titled Vessel. These are all projects that are just completely done. You know, I got a couple beat tapes and things of that nature. And so the next 6 months, 8 months, year is just going to be music for me, you know, just back to back music and Super Duty Tough Work. You know, we're just going to keep going, man. Just keep trying to help people. And we would do it just anyway, but it's a blessing that people pay attention and listen. And so, you know, I'm glad that it is expanded and people tune in. So we're just going to keep trying to do whatever we can to help artists in whatever format that dictates, whether that's books, podcasts, interviews. Try to interview a lot more producers upcoming as well. So, but yeah, that's it for us, man. Just every week trying to help people.
That's beautiful, man. Well, keep doing the thing. We really appreciate you coming on, man. We're big fans and just best of luck in the future. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thanks, Prem. Good night.
All right. Peace.
Peace.
Thank you. Peace.
So that was our conversation with Blueprint, who is among a handful of rappers who are doing podcasts now, and also among a handful of rappers for whom I am jealous of their speaking voice. He definitely smoothness and a calm and just a great interview. So yeah, we definitely appreciate him.
Yeah, and we didn't even really get into it, but he's written like 10 books.
Right,
he's just like insanely productive and committed to sharing the wisdom that he has garnered throughout his long and successful career with other people in a way that's very admirable. And like he's just like a good example of how to age gracefully in hip hop, which is something we talk about constantly. And him and Illogic have this really great rapport, and Super Duty Tough Work is very successful at setting out to do what its stated goal is, which is to give kind of advice, like applicable advice that people can actually use in their real life, where we might give you music recommendations and a couple of jokes. I don't think we're out here for like advice, right?
Totally. No. We need some.
He comes off wise. He comes off very wise, you know, and true to his name, kind of gives you the blueprint for shit, you know.
It's
really good to see. Like you said, I mean, he's a proper example of aging gracefully in hip hop. And damn, I wish I was that productive, man.
Yeah, seriously. I think the approach of Super Duty Tough Work and this idea of like sharing the knowledge is refreshing in a sense, because I definitely know that at times hip hop can be very like closed. Like if somebody's good at something, like they're not gonna tell you how they did it. Hip hop is kind of in some ways notorious for that, so it's kind of refreshing to see Blueprint and Illogic use that platform.
They just did an episode on it's okay to have a day job, and I'm like, thanks guys.
I feel seen. Right? Like, come on, you know, like, because there's these stigmas, right? Like, oh, you're not successful. Screw you. But I feel like they're setting a good example and a new trend. And I can, talking to Blueprint, I can see why the podcast is so successful. So they are our label mates here on Stody Island. Please check out Super Duty Tough Work on a podcast platform near you. Now, if you've been a listener to this program for a long time, and I know that many of you have, you know that support for Dad Bod Rap Pod is brought to you by Manscaped, who is the best in men's below-the-waist grooming. Champions of the world, Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. Manscaped just launched their fourth-generation trimmer, the Lawnmower 4.0. You heard that right, Dave. The 4.0. They just
like your GPA in high school.
That's the honor roll right there.
They sold over 2 million. They went double plat. This is like Tupac's double CD. With the exclusive offer code DADBOD, you can get 20% off and free worldwide shipping at manscaped.com. Support your boys. Go to manscaped.com. Enter code DADBOD and you will get 20% off and free worldwide shipping for the Lawnmower 4.0.
Indeed you will. And then who wouldn't want to be properly groomed? I don't know if you guys noticing this, certainly a thing for me, those like super coarse eyebrow hairs that like go opposite of the direction. I'm just like, this is my new life. This is what the rest of life is gonna be like. Yes. I have like a freaking wire coming out of the top of my head. Like, how did get so thick so fast? I just looked.
Yeah,
I just take out the little trimmy thingy, I get the light, I zip those off. I don't do much grooming, but I think we have to like take a close look at the eyebrows these days. They're a little out of control.
Well, it's like those guys on the Muppet Show. I think it's Randolph and Mortimer. I think the older you get, I suffer from that as well, Dave. I'm sorry, Dave, you don't suffer from that because you're glossy. for us hairier dudes, I do suffer from that. And like using the Manscaped, it's gentle. It cuts the hair, but it's not like aggressively like the shaver that I typically use for my beard. I would never put near the family jewels, although I'm done having kids.
But you know, you're not trying to go for the double vasectomy with the trimmer. Exactly. Dude, that's real talk. I was trimming my beard yesterday, and the lawnmower buzzes at such a lower frequency. Like it cuts the hair clean, but it's like it's chill about it. I turned on one of the other ones and it was like super aggressive. So I was like, we don't need that energy right now.
the lo-fi of ball trimmers. Tap in to the Manscaped Lawnmower 4.0. And also you get to support the program, which we really appreciate here on the Dad Bod Rap Pod. We want to thank everybody for tapping into episode 189. You can connect with us always on Twitter at Dad Bod Rap Pod and on IG when it's working at Dad Bod Rap Pod. We drop new episodes like every Thursday for the past 3 years. It's October and we're tired, but we're also excited about.
Maybe there will be a new way to connect with us soon. Who knows? It's a dynamic world. Things change. People learn.
Foreshadowing. Yeah, we got some announcements coming up in the days to come for those of you who rock with the program. But for now, we will leave you with kind blessings and everybody just be safe. Don't be dumb. That's all I got for you. Just don't be dumb.
Don't be dumb.
See, maybe we are an advice podcast.
What I was going for. I was trying to be like, Super Duty Tough Work is much better at this. But we are going to close with don't be dumb. Listen to the Dad Bod Rap Pod.
It doesn't matter what kind of music you make, rock, rap, opera. The ones that stick out in our heads are the ones that have a certain melody. Like, we all love the Beatles, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
We all like love a Beatles song because we can all sing it. The melody makes us feel good.
Lonely Island Audio.